Well, obviously, it was a very tall order, writing not only the score, but also the songs for the sequel to one of the best-loved movies ever made. And for his troubles, he received 2 Academy Award nominations. From Mary Poppins Returns, music by Mark Shaver. Among the many scores you've written so far, there's one I think should have gotten a nomination for a single cue in City Slickers, when Daniel Stern and Billy Crystal and Bruno Kirby are coming down the hill after bringing in the herd, and they start singing the theme from Bonanza, and the musical accompaniment comes up. And it is, A, so apt and so funny, and actually kind of keeps in time with them. And, you know, these are not...
Well, that's what I do.
Yeah. Exactly.
It's very odd that you said that, because a few weeks ago I was at the Governor Awards, yeah, and someone from Disney came over to me and said, Kevin Feige would like to meet you. Now, this is a man who produces all the Marvel movies.
Sure.
And I was like, are you pulling my leg? Because my husband, Lou, loves the Marvel movies. I thought, he must have called someone at Disney to play a trick. So I go over to Kevin Feige. He says, I'm a film score fanatic, and I especially love City Slickers. Yesterday, I was sitting next to Michael Giacchino, great
sure.
composer. And he said, you know, my son loves film scores, and his favorite of all time is City Slickers. And we even put the City Slickers score against a scene from Star Wars. And it's amazing how it fits. And now you're mentioning City Slickers. It's like, well, what's in the air? I don't know. But
well, it's a great score.
It was only like my second, I think, movie score at all. I did not know what I was doing, which was great, because I just did anything that felt fun.
Yeah, a gift, in other words.
A gift from God.
Well, obviously, I've been joined by a film composer and Broadway composer and composer of lots of other things, Mark Shaman. I know I'm not supposed to say this, but I think without question, it's one of those rare times. I mean, the last time I saw it was Godfather 2, when the second part was as good as the first. And I know that's kind of a heretical thing to say for a movie that has so many fans as the original Mary Poppins.
Well, I'm gobsmacked by you saying that. I mean, I wouldn't go that far. I would say that our intention of what we wanted to do with this movie is successful, and it summons up your feelings and your emotions for the first movie in such a way. Everyone goes in with their arms crossed. How dare they? And they also, unfortunately, didn't use the word sequel enough when they were talking about the movie. So a lot of people for 2 years have been holding a grudge, thinking that we were doing a remake of Mary Poppins. And so I think that's had a lot to do with the crossed arms of people as they walked into the theater. And luckily for us, most people, a lot of people, their arms kind of drift down to their side eventually, maybe even by the end of the first song, because there's a gentle welcome into the movie. It's our love for the first movie. It's throughout this whole movie. It's why we made it. So it's crazy for me that people who love the first movie might be upset by it or even stay upset by it if they go to see it, because it's made for them, because we are them. I couldn't love Mary Poppins more. It couldn't mean more to me. I was 4 years old when the movie came out. I had that soundtrack record. It was my talisman. It was everything to me. I listened to that record and just looked at the pictures endlessly. I couldn't love it more. So anyway, to say that our movie is in any way as successful as the first would be the greatest compliment you could give us. It's our love letter to the first.
Yeah. Have you done a bigger score? I don't think so.
I don't think so. No, I mean, there are moments from other scores that probably, you know, they're kind of big. I mean, that's the nature of film scoring, is there's always some big moments. But this movie is just full of the most lush and unapologetically old school movie style music and theatrical. Like the last great wave of musicals in the early 60s before the musicals suddenly went out of style, but, you know, Mary Poppins and Oliver and My Fair Lady, these movies that just had huge orchestras playing overtures and on tracks. And that was, of all the many fantasies that this movie has fulfilled for me, getting to write a full score like this. And for the orchestra to get to play this, I mean, we recorded with brilliant musicians in England. And I swear, by around the fourth day, a few of them actually smiled.
Yes. English musicians smiling.
Yeah, I even got them to laugh at my jokes by the end of the third week. We scored this movie over 3 weeks, which is so much more than a movie normally has. Maybe nowadays you get 4 days. So we were there for 3 weeks over the space of a year. It was a week here and then a week around sure. half a year later and then a week around a half a year after that. You know, we also pre-recorded all the songs. A strange thing that happened on this movie that has never happened and will never happen again, I can't imagine, is that Rob Marshall, at the pre-record sessions, this is before any movie has been filmed, we're recording the songs, but he says, I also want you to write some score for some of the scenes. I'm like, Rob, I need the movie to do that. I can't do that. He said, oh, yes, you can. So I went home. We had a Christmas vacation between the end of our rehearsal period and then the recording sessions. And I went home and I really thought, well, he's insane. He is just completely insane. And I cannot believe he's asking me to write this music. And I can't believe Disney will pay for an orchestra to play score for a movie that's not been filmed yet. None of this will get used. I mean, who knows what this will be? But he was demanding it. So I talked into my computer and I said the lines and I read the stage directions. This is like some important scenes in the movie. For instance, when the kite first comes to life from the trash bin and goes down the street and up in the sky and into the park and into the storm clouds and little Georgie's chasing it. And then Lin-Manuel's character comes and helps him. And, you know, it's something dangerous is happening. And then suddenly the clouds part and Mary Poppins arrives and comes down holding the kites. And I had this whole scene to score, so I spoke the stage directions as dramatically as I could and left the spots where I thought it would just be imagery, and I just let myself go, which is actually sort of more like how I'm always amazed that I look at all these classical composers here of your CDs, like, these guys didn't have a movie in front of them. What made them write all that stuff? So I just wrote it, and I still thought, this is insane, and we got it orchestrated. I thought, this is insane. We recorded it. Rob even said on this one cue, I think we can lose those 4 bars. I don't think we'll need that. I was like, well, how do you know? I mean, how do you know? Just record it. This is all crazy. Why don't you just record it? He was like, no, I don't need it. Cut to, it's all in the movie. Every single thing I recorded at those sessions, every score cue I recorded, it's all in the movie. Rob is just has such a artistic exactitude about what he thinks and wants, and he just knows it. It seems as if all of us were all in the same room, the costume designer, the music, everyone, like that we all had some congregation where we're like, okay, this is what we're doing, but we're not. That's up to the director to create that feeling. And so that musically shows where Rob is at, that he could do that.
I think the ability to write a memorable tune is sort of a lost art, certainly on the Broadway stage. You know, so much stuff is just so completely tuneless. You know the value of a great melody. Well, number one, you know how to write one. And number two, you realize that all music of any kind, that's the essence of it. Because there wasn't an incontestably great composer from, you know, Bach to the present day who couldn't write great tunes.
Of course, when I think of like, can you imagine like, da, 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 did he know that like hundreds of years from now, all these great classical themes that just live forever and ever, can you imagine what they were thinking the day that they wrote it? Did they have any idea that there could be this kind of longevity to their work? It is amazing. As far as myself, I thank you. And I don't know that I know how to write a melody or a good melody. I just do it and hope it comes out all right. In this case, since we were writing songs that would inform the score and the score informs the songs, I had to think about that. And as a matter of fact, Rob and our producer, Mark Platt, sent Scott and I back to the drawing board on some songs, and it was really mostly about, is it catchy enough? And speaking of catching, it's not like we could ever catch the Sherman Brothers score for Mary Poppins in terms of its catchiness, because that was lightning in a bottle, maybe even for them, that peak experience. I mean, I knew I couldn't possibly come close. And we knew I knew that I'd be attacked for not being as catchy as those songs. Also, the fact that people have heard them for 54 years now. They're part of our DNA of everyone on Earth. So, you know, it's like I say, how can you be compared to the incomparable? But we did our best to try to stay in the same neighborhood musically so that there was continuity, that neighborhood being Cherry Tree Lane, and write our own songs that match the plot and the characters. And that's what the job is. And I feel proud that we did do that. But, you know, Mary Poppins' first song in our movie, can you imagine that? That was, I think, our fourth attempt. And they had already started screen testing Emily singing the song in the underwater sequence of that song. Just they were seeing how they were going to film it. And then Rob said, you know, and this has been months of them embracing the song that we had written at the time, which was more in the style of the early 30s English dance bands. We thought, oh, Mary Poppins is going to come to England in the early 30s, and she's going to know what's, you know, being played at the time. And we had tried to do that, and he says, you know, it's funny. We all love the song, but when you say what's the title, people don't quite sing the melody of the title. They sing like the lyrics coming up to the title. So can you try to think about that and write something else? So Scott and I stopped trying to write in that swing style and stopped being scared of writing in the musical theater style that, dare I say it, Spoonful of Sugar has. You know, it's a rhythm and it's a groove that's been around forever. And I tried to stay away from it, but it was like, well, what are you going to do? So we wrote that. And we wrote the song, and it felt good. And then Scott reminded me before I sent off the demo of me singing it. He said, remember, your job is also scoring. So play it for them. You know, because Scott's thinking, we want to not have to write another song. So prove to them that we've not only written a song, but can you play this like it's film score? So I sat, and I thought for just a minute, and I don't want to say I tossed off, but I sat down and I played our song and I reharmonized it and I played it in a more, you know, mature fashion, and it suddenly had this kind of melancholiness to it. And, you know, just trying to add some nice new chords in it the way you would in a film score, and sent that off. And they were very happy with what we sent. And then I had the brilliant orchestrator, Jeff Edmazian, took this piano part that I played. I played a piano solo. If I'd played it a half an hour later, I would have played it different slightly. But here was this one version I played at that moment. He understands what's in my head. And he orchestrated. The notes are exactly what I play, but he put it into the orchestra in such a beautiful fashion. And first we had an orchestral mock-up created. Nowadays they can create these sound-alike orchestras from the digital recordings of orchestras. And this guy did a brilliant mock-up. And Rob would play it endlessly. And when we met with all the executives the last day of rehearsal, and Rob did a dog and pony show and talked them through all the plot and the costumes and the songs, and he played that one thing over and over again. And then we recorded it with the real orchestra, and then they used that for the teaser trailer, and then we used it for the trailer, which was really nice, because normally I've worked on a million movies. They rarely use music from the movies in the trailer, but in this case they did, and people suddenly were going, they started uncrossing their arms, because the music had this kind of quality that was saying, remember what it was like to be a kid and love something, and you've lost it, but now maybe you can regain it. I mean, the music seemed to say that. So that's why there's a cue on that CD you have in front of us that's called Theme for Mary Poppins Returns. That specific recording does not appear in the movie. Sections of it are in other cues, but that one particular recording isn't. But I beg them to put it on the record, even though we had to write a little asterisk saying, does not appear in the film, so that no one could sue Disney saying, I bought a soundtrack and I only want... you. Because I said that has been like our talisman, which is a word I had to use, look up to make sure I was using it the right way. This thing that I first played on piano, then got orchestrated, and we played, it just has followed us, and I want it to be on the record. It defines the movie for me, and I'm just glad it's there.
Yeah. Richard Sherman, who wrote all of the songs for the original Mary Poppins, was listed as a consultant. And I asked you off mic, you know, so what actually was involved in that? And you told me a wonderful story about it.
Well, he was sent all the material. And if there was anything I think that he didn't like or really thought was, this does not belong in the Mary Poppins universe, he would have said so. And a red flag would have come up. We would have gotten a phone call saying, you guys are out. But luckily that we never got that phone call. And then when he saw the movie, he sent our mutual friend and mutual agent, Richard Kraft, videotaped him talking to Scott and I, just saying what a wonderful job we had done. And he said, thanks for the plugs, because of the little moments in the movie where we do make use of the melodies in the film score. And then we had a glorious afternoon where we sat with him. They videotaped us just asking. I became a four-year-old again, or five or eight, because I've been listening my whole life. So every age, I got to ask him every question I ever wanted to ask. And he asked us about our writing. And the thing that he got so excited, he said, well, you know, the question we always get asked is, what comes first, the music or the lyrics? And Scott and I said, well, the idea comes first, the idea of what the song needs to be. And he got so excited, like, that's it. That's it. That's, these guys are, they know what they're doing. That's it. It's the idea. You know, him and his brother, to me, I don't mean to be sacrilegious, but they're gods to me, as is Irwin Kostel, who was the music supervisor and who did all the underscoring of the first film. These men are gods to me. And if the best I have been able to do is to be the rabbi or the preacher who's simply leading a congregation to honor these gods and to say, we can't quite get there, but let's every day try to achieve this kind of holiness, this godliness that these gods have created. I'm fine if that's the level I'm at. I'm perfectly fine with that. And not only is he a brilliant songwriter, but at 90 years, his hair is darker than mine. I don't know how he does it.
I don't either. Yeah, I first met him maybe 10 years ago. And he looked exactly the same way that he looked 40 years ago.
He's a wonderful presence. And to get, I think of him as my father. I mean, I look at him and he reminds me of my father. And he taught me. It's like the other thing I've thought is, making this movie was for us a way to, like, if you have a teacher who you loved, who really taught you something that you made use of in your life, and then you get to go back to school and say, look at this thing that I made because of what you taught me. Do you like it? And you hope that they're going to say yes. That's what this has been like. And to actually have him there to be able to say, here it is, and you taught me everything. That album was everything to me. It was my elementary school. It was my teaching little fingers. It was my music school. I never had classical training. That record, that was everything.
Yeah. Well, I'm willing to bet this is going to be the same for lots of other people down the line. At least according to the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, the Composer's Branch. Two richly deserved Oscar nominations.
Thank you so much.
Mark Shaiman, we'll all be watching on the, what is it, the 24th?
Yes, and don't feel too sorry for me when they call out someone else's name.
Well, if that is not the case, you can probably quote our mutual friend, Randy Newman, and say, I don't want your pity.
I'm not that way at all. I love people's pity.
Oh, okay.
Give me your pity. If you can't give me the prize, give me the pity.
Mark Shaiman, come back again soon.
Thank you.